My name is Kalinga Begay. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here tonight, sober, and with my family, the Pacific Group. I got sober here, I detoxed here, and I found a new life here. I am 5 years, 2 months, and 1 day sober. And I count them still, because every one of them is extra. I did not tap dance in here from the senior prom. I got sober when I was 50, and I have to tell you that. I look like I made coffee with Bill Wilson, but I didn't. June the 23rd, 1983, I arrived at the Ohio Street Clubhouse. And on that night, I was welcomed to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it had been a long time since anybody had welcomed me anywhere. And if you are new tonight, I want to welcome you, because that was done for me. It made a difference in my life, a tremendous difference. You are welcome here. I am glad you're here. Tonight, I'm going to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I am like now. I'm going to give you some background. Most of the people here who got me sober or were here when I got here know these things about me, but I'm going to give you background so that I can stay sober. Most of my life, I lied about who I was and what I was and how much money I made and what size bra I wore and who my parents were and where I was born and what my bank account was and what my position in life was and who I married and who I didn't and who I slept with and who sold me my clothes and where I ate. I lied about everything. Tonight I am going to tell you the truth. I have learned to do that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born in the garden spot of Los Angeles County, a little town called Tujunga. And I was raised there with Hell's Angels and anybody that was, you know, evading the law, and anybody who was asthmatic or tubercular. It was an asthmatic and tubercular sort of resort, and I did not have asthma or tuberculosis. As a matter of fact, by the time I was 11 years old, I was 5'9", and wore a 36C bra and overalls. I was a very healthy sort of hillbilly, if you will. My family, we have words for it today, nice, kind, rather sophisticated words for it. We call it economic deprivation and lower income level. What we were just poor. We were just poor. My parents were good, hardworking people. They were from the Midwest. My father is a Swede, the firstborn on this side of the ocean, and my mother is an American Indian, and I tell you that because here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're here to learn, and you can tuck that away. This is what it produces. An Indian and a Swede produce this, and you can tuck that away for future reference. little tidbit. My father was raised with a religious background that did not allow drinking or smoking or movies or dancing, or lipstick, or high-heeled shoes, or radio, television. I had tried every one of those by the time I was about 14. So I did not know what alcohol was. And in my youth, I went to work when I was 9 years old, because that's what we did in my family. We needed the money. We lived in public parks and used public restrooms, and we lived behind gas stations and in 22-foot house trailers, and we did the best we could, and we all went to work. I am the eldest of three girls, and I have two sisters who seem to have survived that without having to guzzle gin or undress publicly. I was born with a birthmark on the right-hand side of my face. It was a big purple birthmark. It's still there. Estee Lauder and I worked with it tonight and have it all together. But when I was growing up, I felt different because of that. I also used it as an excuse for many years to drink and to feel different. I used the movies when I was very young, as I used alcohol later on. I snuck into the movies, the Tahunga Theater, and sat there on Saturday afternoon from 1 o'clock until 2 o'clock in the morning and watched those movies over and over again. My, what a wonderful class. They worked for me like alcohol was later to work for me. They created the illusion that life was wonderful and you didn't have to go to work every day and you didn't live in a public park. It created the illusion, and I believed that life, if I got the hell out of Tahunga, would be the way it was in the movies. I thought I would wake up one morning between satin sheets and my makeup would already be on. I'd look better than when I went to bed, and breakfast, lunch, and dinner would be served in the drawing room, and there was no kitchen. Just some woman and butler always appeared with a tray, and there were little dogs who never went poo-poo and never had fleas. And you didn't know what day of the week it was because nobody went to work, and the men wore ascots and lapel flowers, and no one ever raised their voice or passed gas. And that's the way I wanted life to be. I wanted it that way. And it was that way whenever I slipped into the Tahunga Theater. And I was willing to get what we called a whipping every night when I got home in order to have that illusion, in order to have to be removed from reality for that period of time. When I was 9, I went to work frosting root beer glasses in an amusement park, and at the end of that day, I got $3. And those feelings of being ashamed of how I lived and where I lived and less than and wanting to be more than I really was and convince you that I was more than, and the fear in my gut that you'd find out what I really was, I figured money had something to do with getting rid of those feelings. And that night, I tucked that money away, and I believe that I made a decision that no matter what, I would have enough money and enough property and enough prestige to never feel like I felt most of the time. When I was 16 years old, I had worked my way up to a factory job, and the women that I rode to work with were some older than I, and They stopped on Fridays to cash their paycheck at a place called the Bright Spot on Foothill Boulevard in Tahunga. I did not know what you called alcohol, and I didn't know what it was, but I had seen women in the movies drink things out of lovely glasses. And I had seen John Wayne slug down a couple of those whatever they were, and he always looked better for it. And I considered him quite a man, and I considered Katharine Hepburn and Rita Hayworth what I wanted to be. And that night, they opened the door to that bar, and I walked in, and I loved it. I loved that mahogany bar, and the mirror behind it, and the glasses stacked up, and the black piano, and the smell of the men's room, and the smoke, and the dirty ashtrays. And I climbed up on that red leatherette bar stool, and sat down in my overalls, I watched what the woman I was with ordered. I didn't know what to order, and they ordered beer. And I looked at those brown bottles, and I thought, no way. Katharine Hepburn wouldn't drink out of one of those. And so I looked to the other end of the bar, and I saw a tall glass, looked elegant compared to where I'd come from, with food in it and straws and things bubbling out of it. And I told the bartender, I will have one of those. And I did. I had 9 of those that night. We talk about the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it does for us, and it is true. There was a miracle about alcohol, too. Anything that I can ingest that makes me not feel like Katharine Hepburn, but believe I am, is a miracle. And that's what alcohol did for me. Those overalls that I was always trying to get centered between my boobs, you know, one sticking out, they went away. And being 6 feet tall and wearing funny shoes and overalls, that went away. That birthmark didn't matter anymore, and I felt like I wanted to. I felt good. I essentially drank for the effect. I loved it. That night, around the eighth or ninth drink, I got another little effect. It was in my stomach, and I smiled at that bartender with his phony cufflinks and his slick hair and his, what was that Old Spice cologne? I love that smell mixed with a little bourbon. That is home to me. Man, when one of those bartenders comes on shift and he gives it this little shot with those 10-cent cufflinks and he's all slicked back and the bags are pushed up and you can smell that and the booze, I am home. I love bars. I drank in them and I loved them. I am a loner who needs people, and somehow bars and hotels are sort of non-committal. You can live deeply that night and forget it in about 15 minutes on the way to the parking lot. If somebody pisses you off, you can just get up and hit them with a bar stool and leave. The places where I drank, they wouldn't have noticed it much anyway. But that night, I smiled at the bartender and projectile vomited at the same time. I also, here we call it puking, and I puked all over the bar and the bartender and the ladies' room and the piano and the car they took me home in. And the next morning when I got up, I was deathly ill. I was very, very sick, and the first thing I did was count my money, and I had paid somebody 75 cents 9 times. And I considered that, and it was worth it. It was worth it. And I also thought about how sick I was, and I decided that I would never again drink anything with fruit in it. And I never did. When I ordered a martini, I wanted the olive in it. But I was never sure whether an olive was fruit or not, and so I would, when no one was looking, squeeze it and throw it under the bar. I had some luck, considering where I came from. I got to know important people and prestigious people and the inn people and the people who had money, and I was offered jobs and opportunities, and I was married once. I was married for 9 years. I drank up that marriage. I drank up a child, and I drank up the capacity to ever have another child. I was 32 years old, and I had needed this program probably from the time I was 17 or 18. I did not know what was wrong with me, so I decided to keep on plugging for that money and that property and that prestige, and that's what I did. And I'll tell you how it went. I would, by the time I was 32 and drinking like I did, I had the kind of marriage where I called home and said, "I'm going to be a little late, honey. Would you mind just leaving dinner on the stove?" And coming home at 2 o'clock in the morning after rolling around in the back seat of a 55 Chevrolet with some scamp I'd met, coming home to a husband who was faithful. And who went to work every day and who was kind to me. I lied and I tried to make up those excuses and I tried not to show the hangover. And I tried to think of reasons for doing it and I blamed him. And I started the rounds of psychiatrists. And I went to bed with my first psychiatrist. I wanted to get right to the root of things. And what you get are rug burns and then you write a check. I saw 8 or 9 psychiatrists over my years of drinking, and I never told them the truth because I didn't want to look bad. I just wanted the answer, you know. I wanted a name for whatever the hell was wrong with me. I knew there was something wrong with me. I knew it early on. But I thought if I got a name for it, I could fix it. I read self-help books, looking the first 40 pages always, and I figured they don't have the answer. I went to the best psychiatrists when I could afford them. I went to Big Sur and Rolfed and talked to an empty chair and beat the sand with a baseball bat and talked back to myself from the other chair and talked to the problem and then became the problem. Fritz Perls and I, but he's dead now and he was a good man, bubbled around in the bubble bath together. And when I was through, I got out on that highway and went down to that market where they sold booze because I needed a drink. I wanted a drink and I needed one. By the time I was 32, I was working in an industry that had good insurance, and you could swing by Dr. Goodbar's office in Beverly Hills and get a straight shot of speed, you know, like the needle in the hip. And I was getting tired. It was hard to work 12 hours a day and go out and get drunk and get up in the morning and try to glue those eyelashes on and get my hair wired on and get my those seams straight up the back of my heels and get those bags tight enough that they don't make your eyeliner run and look good, you know. I need a little help, so every morning I'd swing through on Charlottesville and get my shot of speed and go into the office. And I want you to know I was a real pile driver. I worked, and everybody else better be working too. You better be doing it right, you better be doing it fast, and you'd best be doing it my way, or I'll fire your ass. It never occurred to me that people didn't get a shot of speed every morning when they came to work. And if they didn't, I would have told them to. I knew what to do. I would leave that place and grind and grind to get my next shot because I needed, it helped me drink. It helped me have the energy left and the capacity left to drink, to seek that feeling that I was okay, that I was beyond okay, that I was omnipotent. That's what alcohol made me feel, that the world was good, that romance was possible, that there were no rocks of despair, and that it was going to be okay. We can do anything. Sometimes I didn't always react that way. Sometimes someone would hurt my feelings, and I would hit them. Sometimes the door would be locked, and I would think they were keeping me out, and I tore the door off, and I learned that they were closed on Sunday. So did the Los Angeles Police Department. I would work my way up, get a job, be rolling, doing great, and one morning, and I cannot tell you when this would happen. I could not predict it. I didn't know there was a pattern until I was sober a while and did an inventory and worked with a sponsor. But I would get up one morning and something in my mind would say, you know, those people aren't treating you right. They don't appreciate you. They don't know how hard you work. When they redid your office, they didn't even consult you about the color of the rug. And that ass that works in the accounting department is out to get you, and he's nothing. By the time I had gotten dressed, gotten glued together, gotten in the car, and gotten to that, wherever it was I was working, I went through that door, never mind good morning, just through the door, up the elevator, and into the big man's office, threw the door open, and said, you know what, Jack, you can take this job and shove it. And I would go home to drink. And I cannot tell you how long those drunks were going to last. I don't know if they lasted 9 months, 3 weeks, 3 months, 2 days. But whenever I was through, wherever I lived, you needed a skip loader to get through. The phone was always disconnected, and there was just one pile in the middle of the floor. In there were the pantyhose without a run in them, maybe. Some things that were still clean enough to wear. And I packed up my makeup kit, my two dogs, and my Siamese cat, and I moved. I left everything behind except the dogs and the Siamese cat. I did that for 25 years. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was living behind the Rose Market at Rose and Oceanfront Walk in my car with two dogs and a Siamese cat. I no longer was pushing to the top. I had an apartment that I was afraid to go into. And when I got in there, I couldn't get out. And so I just didn't go in there. I lived in the car. The phone had been turned off for 9 months, and I didn't miss it. I'm sure the people I called missed it. I had to make long-distance calls to find people who would talk to me, like in Melbourne, Australia. Hi, Don, do you remember 1957? Why didn't it work out? I was working at a job where the client was 10,000 miles away and didn't speak much English. He always sent emissaries, and they don't look for you on Venice Beach. People think that it is sad and dramatic to end up on Skid Row. It is not. It is a relief. There behind that market, I didn't have to glue my eyelashes on or take a bath or worry about what I was going to tell the neighbors because the phone was still off after 9 months. I told them for the first 3 months we were in litigation with the phone company. I didn't have to bathe or try to comb my hair. And I had long ago quit being able to determine when I had to urinate and when I didn't, and it didn't matter. It was a relief. The people there that drank there, I liked. They didn't talk. They didn't want any conversation. I didn't have to wear my black turban and my black box fur and look mysterious. They didn't care. We just sat in that kiosk late at night. Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, about 6 months before, I had seen my last therapist. She was a good woman. She had tried to help me. The last time I saw her, I remember the conversation. It's important. She said, "Kawenga, what are you going to do?" And I told her. I said, "I'm going to be a bag lady." Her answer, I think, is more important. She said, "Yes, I know." And I set about doing that. I wanted it. I did not want to have to suck it in one more day and live in a world that I didn't know how to live in. I had tried everything I could. And that felt good to me. That was the answer. I did not come here to get sober. I came here to learn how to be a bag lady. That's what I thought I would find in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not already know I was a bag lady. My perception was off. On June the 23rd, I don't know what brought me to the Ohio Street Clubhouse. Today I know that God works in my life. If I'm out there doing the footwork, and everything I can, 100% plus 10%, God works in my life. But I have to believe He was working in my life when I didn't know He was and when I wasn't doing 100%, because I landed exactly where I needed to be. I will describe what I looked like. I have saved that outfit. I put it on the day of my fifth birthday to remind me. I was wearing an old pair of black pajama bottoms, urine-soaked, and a blouse with one button on it, and I had somehow managed to get all the other buttonholes up on that one button. I had on a pair of beige springulators, and the heel was gone on one, and I was trying to walk like you wouldn't notice. I hadn't bathed for a long time. I hadn't had a drink in 4 days. And I was sweating, and I smelled funny, and I looked funny. I weighed 325 pounds. I believe that my liver weighed at least 200, and the rest of me was sort of bellowy, you know. Puffy is the word. I had on no underwear. I had long ago given that up. It's so complicated, you know. And I walked up to the Ohio Street Clubhouse, and standing there at the front door was a man with, I mean, squeaky clean, with rosy cheeks and rimless glasses and sparkling eyes and perfect teeth. I had 11 teeth when I came here. I had to smile carefully. They were spaced critically. Luckier than someone here who's more important than I had two front teeth. It was the others that were gone. This guy had a mouthful of teeth and a beautiful shirt and a Harris tweed jacket and wingtip shoes and pants with creases in them you could slice cheese with. The kind of guy that I just hated. I looked at him and I thought, oh, this is not good. This must not be the right place. You see, for me, Alcoholics Anonymous was full of losers. Full of the people that I drank with down on Venice Beach and that I saw up the alleys and that I saw when I was in the better places hanging out behind the parking lots. That's what it was in my mind. You see, being sick and dying doesn't keep you from being arrogant. I am an arrogant and imperious woman. And in that condition, I approached the front door and Rick D. DeVue put his hand out and he said, hi, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. He asked me my name, and I almost left. Where I had been drinking, that was too personal. A question to ask, and I was afraid. I was afraid. I was full of fear. And for a moment, I stood there, and he shook my hand. And I walked into the Ohio Street Clubhouse, and I walked into 250 sober alcoholics, all talking at the same time, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. They all looked like they'd come out of the pages of 17 magazine. Or perhaps, you know, one of those things that McDonald's does, or Pepsi, where everybody looks American, you know, and clean. I thought, my God, this is it. You know, this is it. This is it. And I believe God carried me, just as allowed me to believe in that self-sufficiency until it got me down on my knees. And that's where I was in that Ohio Street Clubhouse, standing in the middle of that aisle, lost. And there was a woman that talked that night, and I remember what she said. She's probably here tonight. Pat H., I don't remember any of her story, but I remember a sentence. And it was a good enough sentence to keep me here that night. She said, you know, it was one of those alcoholic apartments where you've lived there a year and the rug is still rolled up in the corner and the boxes haven't been unpacked yet. Sitting in there not knowing what's going on and not knowing what's wrong with me and not caring. I came here not expecting it to change and believing it never would. And not looking for anything. I came here with that advantage. At the break at that meeting, someone steered me to a woman outside in the parking area. And she said to me, my name is Marianne. Here is my card. How do you feel? I answered her with a question. I believe it's an important question. I said, when do you start to feel better? You see, I came here hopeless, and I came here without any hope and not really giving a damn anymore. And something had happened in that meeting. I don't know what happens in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I know this. It happens. Because it happened to me that night. Somewhere that little spark of hope had started without my knowing it. When do you start to feel better? And she told me, she said, I cannot tell you exactly when, but I can promise you this. I can promise you this. If you meet me at a meeting tomorrow night, you'll feel some better. And I did that. I have not had a drink or a pill or a cigarette or a little NyQuil or any Dos Equis beer. I never considered beer or wine alcohol. I thought you drank wine with spaghetti and you drank beer in the morning when you had a hangover. It was medicinal. I've had nothing but Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor and I went to meetings. When I was 11 days sober, my sponsor is a waitress and she had to work. She told me to go to the yard. I had no idea what the yard was, but the word scared me. It sort of sounded like you would be confined behind chain link. But I had been given a gift, and that was that I believed whatever Marianne King told me. I just did it. I showed up at the yard. It took me 3 hours to get dressed for the yard. I only had one outfit, my purple bag. And she said, when you get there, you've got 11 days. You haven't had a drink or anything for 11 days. And you've washed your hair. I did that at 6 days. I washed my hair and took a bath, put on clean clothes. She said, you've got something to give. You have 11 days sober, and I want you to look for somebody who is sicker than you at that yard, because I won't be able to be there with you. And I found him. Took me 2 hours, but I scanned that crowd. And I walked up to him. He was funny looking. He had one blue sock and one white sock on, and glasses, and a big medal on a grosgrain chain with a big medal on it, and red shorts. And he just circled that yard, and he was always busy, and he was always talking, and he was always moving. And I went up to him, and I said, hi. I had to write down what I was supposed to say. Hi, my name's Kawinga. I'm new. Are you? He looked at me. He really looked at me. And Clancy told me, yes, I am new every day. When my sponsor got to the yard, I said, I found somebody sicker than me. Marianne's lips fluttered just a little. When I was 9 days sober, I got an envelope with $3,000 in it, in cash. And what I do with $3,000 is I split. I go to a hotel. I pick up him in the bar. I have a little costume that I may spend a few bucks on. And I drink. At 8 days sober, I knew somehow deep inside of me that I shouldn't keep that $3,000. And I went to the Hard Rock Cafe to a woman whose name I could not remember. But she was my sponsor. And I walked in there, and it was busy. And she came over, and she said, what are you doing here? And I said, here. And I handed her an envelope with $3,000 in cash in it. She looked at it, and she said, okay, I'll see you at the meeting. I have been taken care of. I have been disciplined and taught and loved. I have become a lady. I look well tonight. I am clean. I have a place to go. I show up. I do not use the excuse that age has anything to do with living. I packed ratchet wrenches when I was new. They fired me because I remembered Pearl Harbor. Packed them with Oriental somewhere, and they could do 12. I couldn't. I just could do 9 and 14. They didn't understand me. I have worked on construction projects, and I have held responsible positions. I have lived 4 years without a car And I never missed a ride because people in Alcoholics Anonymous, sober alcoholics, in my home group, I have a home group, I go to the same meetings. I have the same sponsor. Those people picked me up and took me to Hemet and San Diego and the Yard and conventions and jamborees and commitments in the New Year's Eve show. Last year, in my fifth year, on April Fool's Day, I got a car. That is an AA car. I go to work every day. I'm in the process of looking for a job. I am not afraid most of the time. I am in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. What you see is what I got when I got here. I lived on examples. Don't ask me to go to a meeting unless I see your face there. That's the kind of newcomer I was. Don't ask me to pick up cups and ashtrays unless you're picking them up. There were women and men here who set an example for me. They walked like they talked. They still do. I learned that from them. I learned how to act and how to live and how to walk through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous on a daily basis and use them. What you see here tonight is the best example I can be of my home group, of all that has been given to me, of a brand new life, of a way to live that it took me 50 years to find. And I feel like a new woman. I love this group. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love living. Thank you.